And welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Moscowain. Just in time for the holidays, Omicron has become the dominant COVID strain in the United States. The highly contagious variant now accounts for 73% of new infections, and researchers are still trying to figure out exactly how dangerous it is. The timing could not be worse. With the Delta variant still a big concern and the arrival of flu season, the last thing we needed was another COVID strain that might challenge the protection our vaccines have offered. Meanwhile, holiday travel is expected to approach pre-pandemic levels, so there's lots of opportunity for viral spread. President Biden plans to address the nation today to announce plans for dealing with the latest developments. This hour, the latest on Omicron and how to stay safe over the holidays. Our guests are John Wary, professor and chair of pharmacology and the director of the Institute for Immunology at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Also joining us is Dr. Angela Rasmussen, a virologist at the Vaccine and Infectious Disease Organization at the University of Saskatchewan. Thanks to both of you for being with us on Radio Times.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thanks for having me, Tracy.
Angela Rasmussen, let me begin with you because, as I mentioned, less than a month ago, we just started hearing of this new COVID variant in South Africa, and now Omicron has outpaced Delta as the dominant COVID strain in the U.S. That pace of transmission feels breathtaking. I mean, what do we know so far about Omicron?
I mean, it certainly is breathtaking, I think. And that's one of the things that we do know about Omicron. The doubling time is the fastest we've seen for any COVID variant just yet. That means the time at which cases in the population will double as it spreads through it. So that means that it's incredibly transmissible. It spreads very easily. And unfortunately, it looks like it's pretty good at infecting people who've been fully vaccinated with two doses of the mRNA vaccines that we have available to us. So other than that, though, there's still a lot that we don't know about this variant. So even though we know that it's more likely to cause breakthrough infections, we don't know if it's also going to cause more severe disease in people who have been vaccinated. So far, it's looking, we're cautiously optimistic, I think, that people who are immunized are going to have some protection against disease. And some data from South Africa has shown that that might be the case. We don't know, however, if it's more mild in people who have not been vaccinated. And I think there's every reason to think that it may not be. It may be at least as severe as Delta. And I think we really do need to take that into account. We should not be relieved that we haven't seen people flooding into the hospitals the way that we saw in early 2020, because really we're very early on in this Omicron outbreak and we don't know what the future is going to hold. But there are very, very many unvaccinated people out there who could still potentially be really, really dramatically impacted by this.
John Wary, I think for those people who are vaccinated and have been hearing that Omicron may be able to evade some of the protection that we have, what might a breakthrough infection look like for somebody who has been fully vaccinated and boosted at this point? What do we know about what it might look like?
Yeah, these breakthrough infections are looking a little bit different. So if you're vaccinated, you have at least two layers of immunity. You have these antibodies that we're hearing so much about, and the way the antibodies work is they act kind of like a piece of gum stuck on a key, so the key can't fit in the lock, right? The lock is your cell, and the key is the virus. With Omicron, the key's a little bit more slippery, so the gum doesn't stick, and so the key can get in the lock, the virus gets into your cells. But your immune system has another layer to it, and these are memory B cells and memory T cells. Now, they can't act like a shield like the antibodies do, but once the virus is in, they get activated very quickly. They can help limit the infection, keep it local, prevent it from spreading to your lungs. So in a fully vaccinated person, what we're seeing are mainly mild upper respiratory tract infections, sort of nasal infections, sore throat, sometimes fever. It's not to say that it's not uncomfortable. You might feel kind of sick. But what this level of immunity does is it prevents you from getting very severely ill, prevents the virus from getting down in your lungs and spreading and causing a lot of damage. So these breakthrough infections, while they're important, you can spread to other people, they're more mild if you're vaccinated. And the vaccination, despite the fact that you're getting infected, it's keeping you out of the hospital and, frankly, keeping many people alive.
President Biden is expected to announce sometime today that it will be okay to travel if you are vaccinated and boosted, you wear a mask, you social distance, and take all the appropriate precautions. He's expected to announce that he'll be making 500 million home tests available for free beginning in January. The government is sending military doctors and other medical personnel all around the country to help with some of the overload of cases. And I'm curious to hear from both of you, and John, I'll ask you first, your thoughts about the plans as we know them at this point. Is it enough, and is it too little too late?
Well, I mean, I think the travel, you know, we're seeing that travel, getting on a plane by itself or a train, isn't the risky part. It's how many people you're gathering with and, you know, the way people are gathering. If people can test before the family gathering so that they know that they're negative at that time, that can really help. You know, the vaccines are protecting us from severe disease, and they are keeping a lot of people out of the hospitals. And right now, our hospitals are at the breaking point, and we really can't afford to have more people ending up, you know, needing to go to the ICU or in the emergency room. So I think the travel is only part of it. If we could test more, we'd really have a handle on trying to limit interactions when we know we're positive. So 500 million tests is a great idea. They're not going to be available for a month or maybe 6 weeks, and so it'd be really great to have them ready now at the time people are traveling, so we knew a little bit more. But getting them into production, getting them ready to go is really important and a positive sign in the right direction.
And Angela Rasmus, and I know that you've been following this closely as well and watching all of this unfold, your thoughts on the president's plans for addressing the latest developments?
I mean, unfortunately, Tracy, I do agree with you that it is a little too little too late for the exact reasons that Dr. Wary just said. I personally have canceled my own holiday travel back to the United States from Canada because I don't know that I'm going to be able to access adequate testing supplies to ensure that our family gathering can be completely safe, especially after I'm traveling at an extremely busy time of year. And I think it's long overdue that we're getting 500 million rapid tests. I think that these can be really transformative in terms of helping people begin to adjust to living their lives in a way that is safer, in which they can, you know, have regular real-time updates about what their COVID status is and can make good decisions to avoid exposing people within their families and their communities. But not having those tests available until January is really going to be after the peak season, because last year we had a very big national fall and winter surge that was driven in part by people gathering for the holidays. So unfortunately, you know, I welcome more rapid tests, absolutely. But unfortunately, it is a little bit too little too late in terms of both the availability of rapid tests and the decision really to roll out boosters only to certain age groups.
And John Wary, speaking of availability of home tests, for people who are now thinking about, gee, we should get everybody tested before we get ready for the holidays, unless you bought that test several weeks ago, maybe when Omicron was first a thing, how accessible are those tests right now?
Yeah, I mean, I agree completely here. They're not very accessible. I mean, I actually went and drove around to a couple different pharmacies yesterday trying to find them, one so I knew how accessible they were and because I wanted a few extras to keep in the house. They're not very accessible, and they're actually not accessible probably disproportionately to the people that need them the most. I really agree. I think, you know, throughout the pandemic, we've made a number of mistakes or been a little bit slow on a number of things, but probably testing is the place where we failed the most. Having testing widely available to do contact tracing early on, and now having testing set up so that every business, every school, every individual can test when they want and frequently to try to make sure to keep things contained.
Yeah. There were two quotes from the last few days that I found pretty striking. One was from a patient safety officer at Ohio State University who said that because of the rapid transmission rate of Omicron, quote, just about everyone should be prepared to get infected during this wave, even if you've been vaccinated. The other quote was from a doctor at Johns Hopkins at the Center for Health Security who said, and this is another quote, all of us have a date with Omicron. If you're going to interact with society, if you're going to have any type of life, Omicron will be something you encounter. John Wary, do you agree with those assessments?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, this is what I'm most concerned about. And I'm concerned for vaccinated people, mainly those who can't mount an adequate immune response. But I'm most concerned for the people who still remain unvaccinated. You know, Omicron almost certainly is going to infect every unvaccinated person in this country. We don't know enough, as Dr. Rasmussen said earlier, about the outcomes from Omicron yet. But based on Delta and every strain before that, you have a 1 in 50 chance of dying. So if you're unvaccinated and you hear these quotes and the science is pointing to this inevitability of being infected, your risk of dying is 1 in 50. And, you know, a lot of the vaccine hesitancy is because of concerns about some potential risk of the vaccines, which we could talk about later as being probably, you know, extremely overblown. But the risk from getting infected with SARS-CoV-2 and getting COVID is real, and it's 1 in 50 risk of dying.
And so if I just heard you right, you're saying that if you are unvaccinated, in all likelihood, you can expect to be infected with Omicron.
That's the way it's looking right now. I would say that there are a lot of variables still at play here. We don't yet know with a lot of precision how severe infections with Omicron are going to be in unvaccinated people. So I'm being slightly cautious because there's just not a lot of data yet, and we need to be clear when we know things and when we don't know things completely yet. But it's very concerning. I think this is the reason why many of us in this field were very concerned when we first saw the sequences of this virus and started hearing about how fast it was transmitting.
And Angela Rasmussen, what do you say to the person who is yet unvaccinated, who is hesitating for whatever reason, has more fear of the vaccination than of the virus? What do you say to that person?
So I think it really depends on the person, because in my experience so far, people have a lot of different reasons for not being vaccinated. And I should add, too, that some people who haven't been vaccinated are hesitant, not because they're actually concerned about the vaccines, but because they're concerned about being able to actually get the vaccines. They may not have paid time off in case they get side effects. They may not have transportation or childcare. So there are still significant access issues in many parts of the country, and really for communities that have been disproportionately affected by COVID. So the first thing I say is really, why aren't you getting the vaccine? And then I try to listen first and foremost, because I think that many of the people I've spoken with who say the vaccines are unsafe, well, I heard this, you know, the spike protein is toxic, or it changes my DNA, or it will affect my fertility. All of these various reasons really mean a lot to people, and they're scared and they haven't gotten adequate answers about those things. I think it's really, really important for people who do understand how the vaccines work, and people like Dr. Wary, myself, and our colleagues, to really listen to these concerns and try to answer them directly, because one thing is true for all of these cases, and that is exactly what Dr. Wary said. You have a 1 in 50 chance of dying if you're unvaccinated and you become infected with SARS coronavirus 2.
We have to take a break, but there is much more to come on the latest developments, and they are coming in rapid fire as it relates to Omicron. What do you need to know to keep yourself and your family safe through this holiday season? Much more on Radio Times when we come right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscow-Wain. If you're just joining us, we are talking about Omicron, isn't everyone, as we approach the holiday season. Of course, we learned very recently that Omicron is now the most dominant strain of COVID in the United States. Our attention has been on Delta, but now Omicron seems to have outpaced it in terms of the number of infections across the United States. Of course, all of this is happening as people are getting on planes and trains and automobiles to visit their loved ones over the holidays. And so we need to know what we need to do to keep ourselves and our families safe during this critical time. We invite you to add your voice to the conversation. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, or, of course, you can always call us 888-477-9499. Perhaps you can share your holiday plans with us and how you're working around these issues with COVID, how you've been doing in terms of finding at-home tests, that sort of thing. But we'd love to hear your experience. That said, let me reintroduce our guests. We have with us Dr. John Wary. He is a professor and chair of pharmacology. He's also the director of the Institute for Immunology at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. We also have with us Dr. Angela Rasmussen, who is a virologist at the Vaccine and Infectious Disease Organization at the University of Saskatchewan. Angela Rasmussen, let me start here with you, because the CDC warned last week of a worst-case scenario where we have this triple whammy of Omicron, Delta, and flu season, the influenza virus, converging and just completely overwhelming health systems in various parts of the country and beyond. How likely is that at this point?
Well, unfortunately, I think there's really good potential for it to be very likely in many different communities. We've already seen an uptake in influenza. There's always been a problem with getting everybody to get their influenza shots, but you know, many people have not gotten a flu shot this year, and this is why flu is seasonal. It loves to transmit between people when they're gathered together indoors, like we do during the winter and especially during the holiday season. In many communities throughout the U.S., we still had a pretty high burden of Delta infections when Omicron came onto the scene. And I think this is something that really needs to be explained to people, because a lot of people have said, well, Omicron is maybe milder and I'm fully vaccinated, so I'm unlikely to end up with a severe illness. And that may be true, but the issue here is not just about the individual risk that this poses to a single person. It's about the risk to our entire community. Because if you have a bunch of healthcare workers who are getting flu, Delta, Omicron, can't come to work, then you're going to be short-staffed. If you have already a lot of patients going into the hospital seeking care, and then you have fewer workers, and then you have even more people going to seek care at the hospital, that's how healthcare systems get overwhelmed. So I think that people really need to understand that this is both an issue of safety to themselves and their families, but also an issue of everybody in their entire community being able to access healthcare at a time of the year when people frankly need to access a lot of healthcare, because it is flu season, because there are, you know, icy road conditions, because people are gathering for the holidays, and that creates stress and creates more people going to the hospital for a variety of different reasons. And then on top of it, because of the pandemic and the effect that it's had on healthcare access, there are people who have untreated conditions that were not able to get treatment for during the various big waves of COVID, who might need to seek care for those conditions too. So really what this is a huge potential burden on the healthcare system, and a burden that may actually be overwhelming for it.
Yeah. We have some questions and tweets here from our audience. This is an email question from Daniel, who asks, are the current rapid antigen tests as sensitive for the Omicron variant as for Delta? John Wary?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a huge proponent of the rapid antigen tests, and the vast majority of them seem to pick up Omicron just fine. They're not quite as sensitive as those PCR tests, but the difference is you get the answer back in 15 minutes versus waiting 2 days, sometimes longer, for a PCR test. That two-day delay can be really important, especially with this Omicron variant that spreads more rapidly. So yes, the at-home tests are great. They're still very, very useful. If you show up positive, you should really confirm with a PCR test if you can. So they're a good adjunct, I would say, to the PCR test, and they are detecting the Omicron variant for the most part.
Is it possible that there are times when it's too early to test? In other words, if you've just contracted COVID, maybe you don't have symptoms yet, maybe you won't get them at all, but how much time is necessary for a test to be able to pick up the virus in your system?
Yeah, it's a really important question. There's probably about a day, maybe a day and a half delay in the rapid test showing up positive. So when people have a known exposure, the best advice, if you can, is to test maybe every 12 hours or at least once a day. And it's maybe a 1 to 2 day delay. But those rapid antigen tests pick up the virus when you're most contagious to other people. There will be also a lack of sensitivity on the back end as you start to recover and that rapid antigen test goes negative. The PCR test will still pick up some positivity, maybe still infectious, maybe just debris and garbage left over from your immune system cleaning things up. But there's a delay on each side of that infectious window.
Mm. Question from Erica, who says, one of your guests mentioned a death rate from Omicron of 2 in 50. Was that 2 in 50? Is that what you said?
1 in 50.
1 in 50. All right. To me as a civilian, that chance of something sounds low. But the way that he spoke, it sounds as though he thinks that's a high risk of death. And so the question is, can you put that number in context, that 1 in 50?
Sure. I mean, our death rate from something like yearly influenza is more like 1 in 1,000, 1 in 10,000, maybe even lower. Okay, so compared to other infectious disease, this is an order of magnitude, 10 times, maybe 100 times higher. And, you know, other infectious diseases are even, you know, lower than that, lower than flu. So this is a very high mortality rate from an infectious disease of about 2%. You don't see that. It's 0.1%, 0.01% for yearly influenza in unvaccinated people. So this is a pretty high death rate. To be clear, we don't know this yet for Omicron. We're basing those numbers on Delta and previous strains of the virus, previous variants of the virus. So it remains to be seen what the mortality rate of Omicron is in unvaccinated people.
Yeah. Question from Chris and Angela Rasmus, and I'll direct this to you. He says, some people can't be vaccinated. For those people like myself who are isolating, how do we protect ourselves from Omicron?
So this is a great question because it really gets to the heart of why everybody else should get vaccinated. There are going to be people in our communities who are vulnerable and who vaccines just plain don't work for. Either they may be allergic to vaccines, they may have bad reactions to vaccines, or they may just be immunocompromised and not able to mount robust immune responses after being vaccinated. In the past, this is true for all vaccines. Those people have been protected by the concept of, and I hate to even use this term because it's been so misunderstood, but herd immunity or population immunity. And that is the idea that if enough people in the community are immune, then the virus basically won't be able to find a foothold in that community. Right now, we're nowhere near the population immunity or herd immunity threshold. Even though we've had huge waves, even though 60% roughly of Americans are vaccinated, there are still large populations of unvaccinated people. And as a result, the virus can get into those populations and circulate freely. That creates a danger for those people who are unable to respond well to vaccines. And that's why it is absolutely crucially important for people to get vaccinated and then get boosted if they are eligible, meaning if they're over the age of 16. By getting to this level of population immunity are we going to be able to get prevalence down to the point that the virus can't keep coming back. So right now, it's really critically important. There's tons of Omicron, tons of Delta everywhere. And more Omicron, and it's on the rise. People need to go get boosted. They also need to be implementing these other measures to reduce transmission risk. Once the prevalence is down, there's less virus around circulating in the community overall, and more people are going to be less hospitable to that virus, then it's going to be a lot safer for all of us, for everybody in the community. And I just keep trying to emphasize this point. Vaccines are very beneficial to individuals, but they're most powerful at the population level.
So a couple of things there. So for someone like Chris who cannot be vaccinated, is isolation the most prudent course for someone like that?
Well, I think it depends on Chris's own medical conditions, and that's definitely something for him to discuss with his provider. But that is one option. Another option is to just layer on those levels of protection to reduce transmission risk as much as possible. So wear a good fitting mask or respirator, ideally. So an N95, a KN95, an elastomeric respirator, something like that. Limit the gathering sizes. These are the same things that many of my colleagues have been saying for months now. You know, social distancing, physical distancing, wear a respirator or a good fitting mask, ventilate if possible. Avoid crowds, avoid enclosed spaces, practice good hand hygiene, disinfect high-touch surfaces, and get vaccinated if you are able to. And now we can apply other things too. We can apply rapid tests, as we've been discussing. That can help people identify whether or not they are a risk to the other people that they may be gathering with. We can also, of course, get vaccinated and boosted whenever possible. So somebody like Chris could spend time with household members who are vaccinated, who have taken rapid tests and know that they're not infected. It's not that everybody who can't get vaccinated has to sort of crawl off into like a hermetically sealed compound and stay away from everybody else, but you just need to take many, many extra precautions. And again, emphasize vaccination and boosting for everybody who is eligible and able to do that.
And John Weary, what I think I'm hearing from both of you is just the importance of remembering that this is not about any individual, that, you know, we're not just vaccinating for ourselves. We are thinking about the larger community with all of these decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the societal risk of Omicron is really substantial. I've gotten so many calls from individuals who are concerned, afraid, wondering what to do for themselves and their family. But really, the risk to society is enormous here. We talked about the healthcare system being overburdened. You know, our healthcare workforce is already depleted. We have fewer, staff in the hospitals than we had a year ago because they're exhausted and for a variety of other reasons. And now you layer on additional stress, and the heart attack victims aren't going to get good medical care. So this is not just about COVID-19 or Omicron or, you know, the latest information on vaccines. This is about the entire societal approach to healthcare, and as a consequence, everything else, including the economy. So it really is a societal solution that each of us have a responsibility for.
Yeah. Question here from Vince, who says, my wife and I had planned to visit our immediate family in New York for the holiday. Everyone is fully vaccinated. On Sunday, my uncle decided to invite himself. He is decidedly unvaccinated and at political odds with the rest of us. What is the health risk to ourselves and to him, John?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's real. These individual cases, it's very difficult to put a number on the risk for a single person at a single event. But we know unvaccinated people are at risk for infection. We're seeing Omicron spread at an incredible rate. This is, and we started off, Dr. Rasmussen said it, I mean, the rate of spread here is incredible. So I think unvaccinated people, you know, are at risk, and they're posing a risk to other people. So, people have to make their individual decisions based on their own risk tolerance. My advice is not to go to a holiday gathering unless everybody's going to test the day of. If there are people who are unvaccinated, I think that's a reason I may not go.
Yeah. Angela Rasmussen, how should we be defining fully vaccinated these days? Does it mean two shots? Does it mean two shots plus a booster? How do we define fully vaccinated now?
God, this is such a tricky question because to some degree, it's not to say that this is the last booster we may ever need. One of the things that happened basically in the expedited approval of all these vaccines is there wasn't sufficient time to really optimize dosing to get maximum durability. And of course, as there shouldn't have been, you know, we could not delay bringing these vaccines onto the market. We had to bring them out as soon as they were found to be safe and effective. But normally, during the vaccine approval process, one of the things that makes phase three clinical trials take a really long time is that they do look at optimal dosing strategies for maximizing durability or the length of time that you have protective immunity. That wasn't possible this time around. So we don't really know what is going to be, you know, quote unquote, full vaccination. Will we need boosters every year? I think probably not. But will we potentially need another booster? Maybe. We certainly do have very effective vaccines that are 3, 4, even 5 dose regimens in some cases. We have other vaccines where sometimes you need a booster years later. And it's certainly possible that may be the case with COVID. Now, part of the problem, though, is that we still have so much COVID in the community that people who are vaccinated are going to, on average, be exposed to COVID more frequently. So we will see things like more breakthrough infections. Now, I realize none of this answers the question, which is what's fully vaccinated right now. And that's largely a policy question as much as it is a scientific question. If you need to show proof of vaccination to, say, enter a country, for example, What is going to count as full vaccination? Is it going to be two shots or is it going to be three? And then how do you deal with the inequities for people who haven't been able to access that third booster shot? I know I'm on the waiting list for a booster here in Saskatchewan where I just became booster eligible on Monday. So it, you know, it's something that people really need to think carefully about when crafting policy. Because scientifically, quote unquote, fully vaccinated, meaning you have protection against infection and severe disease, most importantly, is not the same thing as what's going to get me onto this plane, what's going to be safe for going to a business in my community or gathering with family and friends.
Yeah. I was surprised to hear you say that you don't think that we'll have to get a booster every year. Is that right?
That's right. So the reason I don't think that, and this is very, very much dependent on the course of the pandemic, is that, as we've heard many times throughout the pandemic, SARS coronavirus 2 is not influenza virus. For influenza virus, which is what people often compare the annual vaccines to, there are multiple strains, multiple subtypes, essentially thousands of different influenza viruses that could potentially circulate in the human population. Every year, we do our best to guess three or four of those that we think are going to be a problem. And sometimes we get it, you know, we get it more right than other years. SARS coronavirus 2, however, has had now five variants of concern, but they're all fundamentally the same virus. So the difference between Omicron and original recipe SARS 2 is much less than the difference between H1N1 and H3N2 influenza. And for that reason, I think once we figure out the optimal dosing strategy to really lock in protective immunity for SARS-2, unless a completely radically different strain, really almost another virus of SARS-2 emerges, we should be able to maintain protective immunity without needing variant-specific boosters. Now, it's, again, that's entirely dependent on the course of the pandemic, because there certainly could be another variant that emerges that's even more immune evasive than Omicron, and that is going to be able to completely evade all of the antibody responses elicited by the original recipe vaccine. Yeah, so I'm not saying for sure we're not going to need it, but we might not, especially if we manage to get prevalence down.
Hmm. So much more to talk about as we discuss the Omicron variant, now the dominant strain of COVID in the United States. Your questions for our guests when we come back on Radio Times. We'll be talking more about Omicron and what you need to know as the holidays approach. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And we're back on Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking about Omicron, now the dominant COVID variant in the United States. It accounts for something like 73% of all infections nationwide and many more in certain parts of the country. Our guests are John Wary, professor and chair of pharmacology and the director of the Institute for Immunology at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Also with us, Dr. Angela Rasmussen, a virologist at the Vaccine and Infectious Disease Organization at the University of Saskatchewan. We're talking about the fact that Omicron is outpacing Delta just as the holidays approach, as people are traveling to be with loved ones. Everyone is asking, what do we need to know? How do we protect ourselves? We invite you to add your voice to our conversation. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. Tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Call us at 888-477-9499. John Wary, you were quoted in an NBC News article recently as saying that even if our antibodies wane over time from vaccinations, our immune systems may have some, as you called them, backup plans that would provide some resilience against Omicron. In layman's terms, what does that mean?
Yeah, so our immune system is really fascinating. And so the way that our immune system protects us from viruses is it makes these soluble things called antibodies, and that's what we're all hearing about. You know, there are these proteins that float around in our blood or in our nasal passages that act to really prevent the virus from ever getting into our cells. But when we get vaccinated, our immune system also trains what I call the backup plan. These are cells of our immune system that are highly specific for and remember that SARS-CoV-2 spike protein for months or years. Now, what's different, antibodies prevent the virus from getting in. Once the virus gets in, these cells, they're called B cells and T cells, they can either make more antibodies, that's what the B cells do, or the T cells go around and essentially kill those infected cells and prevent them from making more virus, thereby preventing the virus from spreading to neighboring cells or down into your lungs. So those B and T cells act like the backup plan. If you break the initial defenses, that shield of antibodies, those B and T cells come online pretty quickly within a couple days and prevent the virus from spreading and the infection from getting out of control. So whereas the antibodies protect you from ever getting infected, that backup plan, if you get a breakthrough infection, that backup plan prevents you from getting severely sick, prevents you from ending up in the hospital. You might still have symptoms, but typically those symptoms are going to remain in your upper respiratory tract, your sinuses, sore throat, not progress to full-blown pneumonia and really severe what we call systemic consequences.
Angela Rasmussen, what about the group of people who has only had one shot? It's unclear how many of them there are, but for whatever reason, there are a number of people who have kind of blown off that second shot. What do you say to them, and how protected are they as we look at Omicron just sort of taking over in the United States?
Well, as time goes by, it's very apparent that a single shot or a single dose of any of these vaccines, including Johnson & Johnson, really doesn't provide adequate protection over time and is not very durable. So to those people who've only had one shot, whether they've had Johnson & Johnson and haven't gotten a booster yet, or whether they've just had one single dose of an mRNA vaccine, I say get a second shot as soon as you possibly can, because we know that at least with the second shot, that will provide a huge boost in those neutralizing antibodies that can protect against infection. It also really gives a sort of an advanced lesson in SARS coronavirus 2 to the memory B cells and memory T cells that Dr. Wary has been talking about so eloquently. You really do get profoundly better protection from getting that second dose. Now, I do want to say that there are some people who've had a single dose, and I've spoken to people whose situation is such that you know, they had a bad reaction to their first dose of the vaccine, and a medical provider has told them not to seek a second dose, at least of the same vaccine. For those people, that's something definitely to work out with their individual provider who's more familiar with their medical background and their medical history. But I will say that there are new vaccines potentially coming out that may be an option for those people. Novavax, for example, which is a protein subunit vaccine, that's more similar to technology that's used in other vaccines, such as the hepatitis B vaccine, may be an option for those people. And Novavax has now received approval by the WHO and by the European regulators. So it's possible that we may be seeing approval for Novavax in the U.S. and in Canada very soon. I would definitely encourage people to not just leave it at that if they've only gotten one shot, because there may be other options for them.
Well, just as a follow-up to that, and I'll direct this to you, John Wary, there are at least two COVID-19 treatments in the pipeline that we're aware of, in the form of pills, one from Merck, one from Pfizer. How well do they work, and how soon might they get FDA approval?
Yeah, that's a really important question. I'm glad you brought this up. You know, we're moving forward on all fronts. We're moving forward to understand and improve our ability to deliver vaccines and boosts and understand how often we're going to need them, but also in other therapeutics. We have two classes. We have monoclonal antibodies that we can use in people who can't mount a good immune response or early in disease to help limit disease or help replace what your immune system can't make on its own. Those were really effective until Omicron. And Omicron now has evaded most of those monoclonal antibody therapies that we had available. So, you know, we have to keep, you know, one step ahead of the virus if we want to actually have good therapeutics. But we do have this other class of therapeutics. These are pharmaceutical drugs. There are two of them, one from Merck, one from Pfizer. They look pretty good. The Merck drug didn't receive approval because its efficacy was rather low. It's still being evaluated. It may still be an advantage. It's about 37% effective. But then the second drug actually looks much more promising, and that may be as high as 80% effective or more. What's really nice here is they work on different parts of the virus. So there's hope in the future we'll be able to combine them to actually essentially trap the virus so it can't really escape from these therapeutics. And these therapeutics work very differently than our immune system. So they're going to be effective against Omicron. They're going to be effective against Delta. And so far, they should be effective against any of the variants of concern that we've seen thus far. So our hope is they'll be available sometime early next year and maybe a really useful tool in people who are severely ill or get infected with Omicron.
Yeah, really encouraging news on that front. Some more questions from our listeners. John asks, why would people with natural immunity need the vaccine? John?
Well, first of all, I really am not a big fan of the term natural immunity. Your immune system is natural no matter how it's taught. So the immunity you have from vaccination is also natural. So immunity from infection, what we're seeing so far is it's much more variable than the immunity you get from vaccination. So that means that across the population, some people may have very high levels of antibodies, some people may have very low levels of antibodies. Those antibodies may decline at different rates. After vaccination, your immunity is much more consistent at the population level. We're also seeing, now that we're talking about Omicron, that previous infection, immunity from previous infection, does not seem to offer very good protection from Omicron. It's early days. Let's wait and see what happens. But that's the emerging data that's becoming more and more clear by the day, actually.
Yeah. Angela Rasmus, and this question comes from Tom, who says, I realize I might be less at risk of contracting COVID and having severe symptoms if I'm fully vaccinated and boosted. But what about the long-term health effects?
The long-term health effects of vaccination and boosting, or the long-term effects of getting COVID?
Of COVID.
I just want to make sure I understand the question.
Yeah, just to clarify. Right. So what about long-term health effects of COVID? If you do, in fact, contract it, even if you're vaccinated and boosted and all of that, you know, we hear all this talk about long COVID. What do we need to think about?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question. And this is going to fall squarely in the category of what Dr. Wary said earlier about needing to be honest and upfront about areas of great uncertainty. So we still don't really know that much about the risk of long COVID for people who have been fully vaccinated and then contract COVID. But the preliminary data does seem encouraging. People who are vaccinated and have so-called breakthrough infections tend to have more mild, more self-limiting disease. And there are some preliminary reports, but again, this needs to be taken with a big grain of salt because it's still early days, that people who are vaccinated and have breakthrough infections have a much lower rate of long COVID. Now, that seems to make sense to me, just understanding how the immune system works. If you are going to be infected with a virus and the immune system can rapidly clear it, it's going to be less likely to exert sort of off-target effects on other parts of your body and other organ systems that can lead to chronic illnesses like long COVID. But that said, we still don't really know what causes long COVID. We don't know if it's because of persistent infection or if it's because of persistent inflammation or if potentially it's because of both. So I think that this is something where we really, really need to continue doing research. But one thing is very clear, and that is that you are much more likely to have a positive outcome if you have a breakthrough infection than if you get infected and you are unvaccinated.
John Wary, question from Sandra, who says, my daughter is 18. She is not due for a booster until mid-January. She's working in the food industry, and I'm concerned about her. Is it safe for her to get the booster early?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and I hear this a lot. The exact timing of the booster is a sort of an approximation. We have to make recommendations. We have to have guidelines. There isn't any magic number. We do know that your immune system becomes more boostable if you spread out the time between initial vaccination and the boost. That's because these memory B cells and memory T cells mature over time and actually get more fit over time. So if you give them a bit of rest, they actually boost better. But what exactly that time frame is in one individual versus another, there's no magic number. So if you're in a high-risk position, career, boosting a month early or a few weeks early, there's no problem with that. You do want to give the immune system maybe a couple or 3 months at least from an exposure, whether vaccination or infection, before boosting. But whether it's 5 months or 6 months, it should be fine.
Yeah. Angela Rasmussen, since we're talking about work here, there's a question from Emily who says, do you advise working from home for those who have the ability?
Yeah, right now I do. I think that, Omicron is a real risk, and several people at my own office, where we are all fully vaccinated, have had breakthrough infections over the last couple weeks. So it is something that anybody who is leaving their house to go be in an enclosed space with people who are outside your household are potentially running the risk of. If you are able to work from home and it doesn't have any consequences for your job, then I do recommend that you do that. Right now is the time. You know, we don't have to, again, completely retreat from the rest of the world entirely, but by limiting your interactions with people from outside of your household, you, especially if rapid tests are not going to be used all the time, and indeed they're not available in many places for that regularity of use, it is a smart move to work from home if you are able to do so.
And here is the all-important question, Angela, follow-up from Joan, who says, for those of us fully vaccinated with a booster, especially as the holidays are coming, is it relatively safe to go to a place like the hairdresser with a mask, or should we go back to total avoidance?
Yeah, I think that's the kind of thing where, again, this comes down to your own personal risk tolerance. But, and just speaking for myself personally, I desperately need to go to the hairdresser. So this is something I will be
doing.
Don't
we all?
fully masked, of course. But yeah, I think, you know, talk to the businesses that you want to go to. See what their COVID protocols are. Many places like salons are limiting the number of customers that might come in. In different communities, there are different policies that are required. Some places have mask mandates, some don't. Find out what your businesses that you want to patronize are going to do to make that experience as safe as possible, and then decide for yourself if that's a risk that you're willing to take.
John Wary, as we're having this conversation and as I was preparing for this conversation, I was thinking about all the things that have happened of late. We've got professional sports rescheduling or slowing down their schedules. We've got Broadway shows that are shutting down. We've got the Radio City Christmas show canceled for the rest of the year. Schools are going back in some cases to remote learning, or at least they're thinking about it. In so many ways, even with the vaccines, it feels like 2020 all over again. Speak to that person who has that sense of deja vu and is just feeling exhausted by all of this.
Yeah, we're all exhausted. I mean, the you know, scientists and policymakers as well. But we're not in March of 2020. We have vaccines. They do work. They are changing the dynamics of what happens if you do get an infection, shortening the course of disease, getting you back to your normal life more quickly. Consequences to the family around you are much less severe. You're putting them at less risk, transmitting less. Even though we're not at zero, the vaccines are not a perfect solution, they've changed the dynamics dramatically. And as we commented on a minute ago, we have these new therapeutics coming online. While it seems troubling, Omicron has definitely been a major shot across the bow, a wake-up call that we're not out of this yet. But we're in a very different place than we were a year ago or 18 months ago.
Yeah, which is very encouraging in light of the developments that are just coming at us rapid fire every day.
Absolutely.
Angela Rasmussen, in our last minute or so, what are your expectations as we all move forward into 2022? How do you see things playing out next year, and what might 2022 look like? And I realize nobody's got a crystal ball here.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, at this point in the pandemic, you're not going to catch me making any definitive predictions, because most of the time when I see people doing that, they usually end up being very, very wrong. And at the very least, I don't want to jinx us all. But I do think we are on a slow path to endemicity. And really, to me, the question is, how long is that going to take? And that depends on how fast can we get vaccines out and boosters out, not just to people in the U.S. and Canada, Europe, et cetera, but to the entire world. that is going to determine the speed at which we sort of emerge from this pandemic and return to something that looks like what we used to call normal life.
Yeah. Well, the news is changing every day. The developments are new every day. I know that both of you will be keeping on top of it. We'll all be watching and waiting to see what happens. But I want to thank you both, John Wary from the University of Pennsylvania, Dr. Angela Rasmussen from University of Saskatchewan. Thank you both for taking the time to kind of talk us off the ledge here and help us understand what we need to know about Omicron, how to keep ourselves and the people we care about safe. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thanks, Tracy.
Thank you.
It was great having you both with us. Thanks for listening to Radio Times. Our producers are Debbie Bilder and Paige Murray-Bessler. Our engineer has been Diana Martinez. And I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowain. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY.